through the service door, skating the edge of the parking lot just before more cops swept in, setting a perimeter around the building. Evan peered across to the outer fringe of the lot. Even through the windshield glare, he could discern the outline of the man in the rental car. He was trapped for now. The cops had blockaded the exits. Joey took note of the man. The lookout? Yes. Evan hustled her away from the commotion and into an employee parking lot, shielded from view by a flank of the building.
Is the car this way?
She asked. No, I parked it a block to the south.
Then why are we here?
He stopped by a canary yellow Chevy Malibu.
Evan, this isn't the time to swap cars again. We can't drive out of here anyways. You saw the exits.
Dropping to his back, he slid under the Malibu. He unscrewed the cartridge oil filter and jerked it away from the leaking stream. He wiggled back out from under the car. She saw the filter and said, "Oh." And then,
"Oh."
He shook the filter upside down, oil lacing the asphalt at his feet. Then he examined the coarse threading inside. "Give me your flannel." She took it off. He used it to wipe oil from the filter, and then his hands. It wasn't great, but it was the best he was going to do. Holding the filter low at his side, he stepped over a concrete divider onto the sidewalk and started arcing along the street bordering the station, threading through rubberneckers.
"Why are we risking this?"
Joey asked.
"Right now?"
"Given their response time, these guys have some kind of headquarters in the area. We saw at least 7 more men at your apartment building, including the orphan. We find the HQ, we get answers."
"You think the guy's just gonna tell you? This place is swimming with cops. It's not like you can beat it out of him."
"Won't have to." They came around the fringe of the parking lot. The lookout's car was up ahead, backed into its spot, the trunk pressed to a row of bushes. The majority of cops were at the main exits or across the lot at the station proper, scurrying around, gesticulating and talking into radios. Evan removed his slender 1911. He knew that the threading of the oil filter would be incompatible with the threading of the barrel, so he tore a square of fabric from the flannel, held it across the mouth of the filter, and snugged the gun muzzle into place. A makeshift suppressor. They skated behind a group of looky-loos who had gathered by the main entrance and vectored toward the rise of juniper hemming in the parking lot. Evan said, "Wait here." He sliced through the bushes. 3 powerful strides carried him along the driver's side of the sedan. The lookout picked up on the movement in the side mirror and lunged for a pistol on the passenger seat. Evan raised his 1911 to the window, held the oil filter in place at the muzzle, and shot him through the head. The pop was louder than he would have hoped. Between the flannel patch, the oil, and the muzzle flash, the filter broke out in flames. Evan dumped it onto the asphalt and stomped it out. He squatted by the shattered window and watched, but no one seemed to have taken notice. He opened the door, releasing a trickle of glass. The lookout was slumped over the console. Evan wiggled the guy's wallet and Samsung Galaxy cell phone from his pocket. Then he lifted his gaze to the object of his desire. The Hertz never-lost GPS unit nodded from a flexible metal stalk that was bolted to the dashboard. Evan tried to snap it off, but the anti-theft arm required a crowbar. He sank back down outside the car, reshaped the flattened cartridge oil filter as best he could, and firmed it back into place over the muzzle. The sound attenuation of the first shot had been far from spectacular, and he knew that a makeshift suppressor degraded with every shot. But he was short on time, and short on crowbars. He took a few breaths. Juniper laced the air. Bitterberry, pine, and fresh sap, undercut by something meatier. He leaned into the car, aimed at the spot where the stalk met the dashboard, and fired. The unit's arm nodded severely to one side. He glanced through the blood-speckled windshield, saw some of the cops' heads snap up. They were looking around, unable to source the sound. As Evan worked the metal arm back and forth, several cops moved into the parking lot, Glocks drawn. They were moving row by row. The stock proved stubborn. He sawed it back and forth harder, polyurethane foam swelling into view on the dash. A female cop worked her way up the line of vehicles directly ahead of Evan. In a moment, she'd step around the end car, and they'd be face to face. The unit finally ripped free of the molded plastic above the glove box. Evan backed out of the car, already powering down the GPS so it couldn't be accessed remotely. Staying low, he reversed through the juniper. He saw the cop come clear of her row and spot the windshield an instant before the foliage wagged back into place, enveloping him. He popped out the other side onto the sidewalk, bumping into Joey. He handed her the Neverlost, unscrewed the filter from the tip of the pistol, and dumped it into a trash can. Then he holstered his 1911 beneath his shirt, took Joey's hand like a doting father. She understood, folding her clean fingers around his, hiding the oil smudges. They crossed at Irving Street, blended into a throng of pedestrians, and headed for the family car. 19. More Than a Mission. November was a pleasant month in Alabama. Van Sciver sat in a rocking chair, sipping sweet tea. On his knee rested an encrypted sat phone, the screen dancing with lights even when it was at rest. The plantation-style house wasn't so much rented as taken over. Though relatively humble compared to some of the mansions in the region, the place still showcased classic white woodwork, a formidable brick chimney, and an impressive pair of columns that guarded the long porch like sentries. It was a national historic landmark, which meant that it was under federal jurisdiction. The Department of the Interior, to be precise. The orphan program had a special relationship with the Department of the Interior. When the DOD required cash for program operations, they made use of the bureaucratic machinery of Interior, figuring correctly that this was the last place that any inquiring mind would look for selected acquisition report irregularities. The money itself came straight from Treasury, shipped immediately after printing, which made it untraceable, and which meant that Van Sciver could quite literally print currency when he needed it. The life of an orphan was not without hardships, but those hardships were cushioned by secret 8-figure bank accounts sprinkled throughout non-reporting countries around the world. When forced to leave his data mining bunker, Van Sciver didn't generally pull strings with Interior. But this mission was more than a mission. It was a celebration. So he'd made a single phone call, the effect of which had rippled outward until he found himself here, sipping sweet tea on the veranda, waiting for mosquitoes to stir to life, so he could swat at his neck with a kerchief, just like they did in the movies. One of his men circled, his bushy beard and sand-colored FN SCAR 17S battle rifle out of place here among the weeping willows and lazy breeze. "Perimeter clear," he said as he passed, and Van Sciver raised his iced tea in a mock toast. Jack Johns had been the number two on Van Sciver's list. But killing him was not what had given Van Sciver his current glow of contentment. It was the fact that killing him had made Orphan X hurt. That alone was worth the cost of a Blackhawk and six men. Van Sciver's history with Evan stretched back the better part of three decades to a boys' home in East Baltimore. Their rivalry at Pride House had been nearly as vicious as it was now. Van Sciver had been a head taller, with twice the brawn. He'd been the draw, the one they'd scouted for the program, the one they wanted. And yet Evan had squirmed himself into position, had gotten himself picked first. Now Van Sciver held the keys to the kingdom, and Evan was a fugitive. Van Sciver had played the long game, and he had won. Yet even here, rocking soporifically on a centuries-old porch at a mansion requisitioned on a whim through the federal government, even surrounded by ranks of trained men ready to do his bidding, even with the levers of power awaiting the slightest twitch of his fingers, he knew that it wasn't enough. It would never be enough. The phone chimed, the call routing in through Signal, an encrypted app developed by Open Whisper Systems. Every call, made over a Wi-Fi or data connection, was end-to-end protected, the only encryption keys controlled by app users. As he did with all security measures, Van Sciver had gone above and beyond, tweaking the code slightly, altering the protocols. He eyed the screen, which displayed two words, Adder Lustful. He thumbed to answer. Code, he said. He heard a rustle as Orphanar eyed the words displayed on his end. Adder Lustful. The matching code verified that the call was secure. No man-in-the-middle attack had occurred. Van Sciver said, Is the package in hand? Orphanar said, We didn't get her. Because? A hesitation spoke to Thornhill's dread. X showed up. Took out four of my men. Van Sciver found himself actually using his kerchief to mop sweat off his neck. How many men did you have at the train station? Four. Van Sciver had no response to that. We thought it was just the girl. The surveillance cameras picked up only her, alone. We thought it'd be a quick snatch and dash, and then we could use her to lure him in. Instead, he lured you in. Seems that way. Van Sciver leaned forward in the rocking chair, set his glass down on the uneven planks of the porch. We have unfinished business here. I want you back. Shouldn't we stick around in case X rears his head? Leave your team in place there. But you won't find him. He and the girl are gone. You missed your shot. There was an even longer pause. I'm on a plane. Van Sciver hung up. He picked up his glass and tossed the remaining tea into the hydrangeas. The time for celebrating was over. 20. Wayward Pieces. It took some doing, but Evan found a motel on par with the beauty in Cornelius. Stale cigarette smoke oozed from the bedding, the towels, even the popcorn ceiling. The toilet was missing the tank lid. A pull-chain table lamp with a yellowed shade threw off a jaundiced glow. The comforter sported a stain the color of dried blood, which Evan hoped it was, given the less appealing alternatives. He'd rented the room for 3 hours, which explained everything worth explaining. Now he sat cross-legged on the floor, the Hertz never-lost GPS unit before him. Still attached to the metal stalk, it resembled a dismembered antenna. The lookout's wallet and Samsung were laid on the floor beside the stalk, parallel to each other, edges aligned. Order helped him think. Joey leaned her shoulders against the bed, her hand working what seemed to be a steroidal Rubik's Cube that she'd produced from her rucksack. She spun it with the speed and focus of a squirrel stripping a walnut. Evan opened the lookout's wallet. It contained four crisp $100 bills, and nothing else. All the slots and crevices were empty. He set it back in its place. Then he turned on the Samsung and checked the contacts. There were none. Email was empty, as was the trash folder. No recent calls. No voicemail. The clacking of Joey's Rubik's Cube continued, grating on his nerves. Without looking up, she said, No luck, huh? He ignored her, powering on the never-lost GPS. When he searched the settings, he saw that everything had been deleted from this device as well. No saved locations, no last destinations, no evidence that the unit had ever been used. Clack, 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 clack. Can you please stop that? She halted, cube in her hands. The thing had exploded outward into different planks and beams, an architectural scribble. He frowned at it. What is that thing? This? She turned the monstrosity in her hands, showing off its various dimensions. It's a 3x3x5. Cubers call it a shapeshifter. What does it do? Gives you a headache? Like you. She flashed a fake grin, let it fall from her face. She returned her focus to the cube. Her hands moved in a flurry, whipping the various planes around. You have to solve the shape first. Wait, wait. See? She held it up. She'd wrangled it back into form. It looked like a miniature tower. Then you solve the colors. This part's easier. There are algorithms, sequences of steps. To him, it was just a blur of primary colors. You have to look for the wayward pieces, find the patterns that make them fall into place. Like so. She held it up, finished, gave it a Vanna White wave with her free hand. Impressive. They say girls suck at geometry, but they forgot to tell me that. He would have ignored them anyway. She tossed the cube into her rucksack, flicked her chin at the GPS unit. How's it going with that? They wiped everything. Can I use your laptop? I need to get into this thing. She shrugged. Sure. She retrieved her laptop and a USB cable, watched him plug in the Neverlost. What you doing? Even if they deleted everything, the GPS still has coordinates, destinations, and deleted routes stored internally somewhere. He set to work. First step of a forensic recovery is to image the data. It's called mounting the file storage system. Then you make a copy of the device's internal memory in your computer, but contain it so it can't infect your own data. Then I'm gonna wade through it, determine the data structures, see where and how the data's stored, what kind of encryption I'm dealing with. Like jailbreaking a phone. Understand? She tilted her head at the screen, taking in his progress, then looked at him with an expression he couldn't read. What grandpa taught you to hack? You learned that when COBOL and IBM S370 were state-of-the-art? This joke seemingly amused her. He said, What? Maybe you could use a dial-up modem. Or like we could get a bunch of hamsters on wheels to power the software. He stopped, fingers poised above the keys. You have a better approach? You're using a memory dumper program, she said. Why don't you spin up a new local virtual machine like any idiot would? Image, and then boot the virtual device inside it. Use the security analyst's desktop code to do the heavy lifting. Blowing hair out of her eyes, she spun the laptop around to face her. Her fingers moved across the keyboard, a virtuoso pianist hammering through Rachmaninoff. Then she flicked the laptop back around to him. The screen was doing lots of things, and doing them speedily. She settled back against the bed again, as bored as ever. He read the coding here and there, catching up to it well enough to start directing the software. "Let me see the phone," she said. "I already checked it. It's been wiped. Two sets of eyes are better than one, especially when the second set is mine. Trust me, there's no point." She plucked up the Samsung, started thumbing at it. The laptop spit out some results. It took Evan a moment to decipher them. "Shit," he said. "Hmm?" The phone made little tapping noises, its glow illuminating her round face. "Looks like they used a secure erase tool," he said, "layered over the data with 12 hours of alternating ones and zeros." "There is a shortcut, you know." He closed the laptop a touch harder than necessary. "What's that?" "Oh, I don't know. Maybe the Waze app on his phone." She held up the Samsung to show the nav application lighting up the screen. "It shows where the cops are, accidents, traffic jams. You know, useful stuff for lookouts and getaway drivers. Why did you think he had a phone?" Heat rose beneath Evan's face. "To make calls." "To make calls," she said. "That's so cute." "The app. It has all the routes?" "Yeah, but we don't need them." "Why not?" "Because look what happens when you touch the smiley car." She pressed the icon. A column of recent destinations came up, the second one down. An address in Portland's Central East Side was labeled HQ. "That's what we in the spy business refer to as a clue," she said. Evan rubbed his eyes. "You really need to watch your nonverbal tells," she said. He lowered his hands to his lap. "You have location services turned off on that phone, right?" "Of course." "Power it off anyway, just to be safe." She did. Then she tossed it back onto the worn network of threads that passed for a carpet.
When you said they could pick me up on the surveillance cameras at the train station, I thought you were being paranoid. But it's not paranoid when you're right, is it?
I need to get you far away from here before we put you on any kind of public transportation. I'm talking multiple states away.
What about the headquarters?
She tapped the phone.
I mean, we're 40 minutes away.
You drive me to Idaho and come back. They'll be cleared out by then. What am I supposed to do with you?
She just looked at him.
No. No way.
Give me your gun.
She stared him down, unblinking. Finally, he unholstered the skinny Ares and handed it to her. She regarded the slender 1911 with amusement, turning it this way and that.
Nice gun. They make it in pink.
Only if you special order it.
It goes well with your hips.
Thanks.
You should accessorize it with, like, a clutch purse. Maybe a string of pearls.
Are you done?
Just about.
He waited.
She said, if you pull the trigger, does a little flame come out the end? Or a flag that says, bang,
Joey?
Okay, okay, she said. Go to the lamp.
He rose and walked over to the table lamp.
Turn it off. Count 5 seconds.
Then turn it back on. He pulled the chain, the room falling into darkness. A 5 count passed, and he turned the light back on. The 1911 rested in front of her crossed legs. It had been field-stripped. Frame, slide, bushing, barrel, guide rod, recoil spring, spring plug, and slide stop. In a nice touch, she'd stacked the remaining 4 rounds on end on the magazine. Her gaze held steel.
Again, she said.
He tugged the chain once more, counted to 5, clicked the lamp on.
The pistol. Reassembled.
She had a tiny dimple in her right cheek, even when she wasn't smiling. She wasn't smiling now.
You can be my lookout, he said,
but only because it's safer for you to be near me than on your own.
Gee, she said. Thanks.
She stood, twirled the gun on her palm, and presented him with the grip. He took the Ares and clicked it home in his high-guard Kydex holster.
What if they're expecting you? She asked.
Even if they are, he said, it won't help them.
21. Quick and easy.
Central East Side was an industrial district checkered with low-rent housing. Evan coasted in the stolen Subaru with the switched rear license plate, watching a parade of radiator shops, commercial laundries, and wholesale construction supply joints march by. The streets were pothole-intensive, shimmering with broken glass. A few spots had been taken over by brew pubs and distilleries, gentrification doing its cheery best, but they were out ahead of the curve here and, from the looks of the clientele and graffiti, in over their heads. Joey took in the streets, and seemed not uneasy in the least. She wore a half-squint, her taut cheeks striking, the youthful fullness of her face turned to something hard and focused. Evan found himself admiring her. She was a medley of contradictions. Surprises. They drove for a time in silence.
I need a shotgun, Evan said.
I'm sure we could rustle one up in these here parts.
Last thing we need is to go down the rabbit hole dealing with local criminals and wind up with a rusty Marlin goose gun. We need something well-maintained, and we need it quick and easy.
Where are you going to find a shotgun like that on no notice?
The police.
Of course. Quick and easy.
She cast a glance across the console. Did a double take.
You're not joking, are you?
Evan pulled over beneath the green cross of a marijuana dispensary, fished out his rum zone, and dialed 911. The cruiser pulled up, and 2 venerable cops emerged, slamming the doors behind them. The driver hit the key fob, the car putting out a chirp-chirp as it locked. Joey sat on the steps of the dispensary, holding Evan's phone and pretending to text. Her dark, wavy hair fell across her face, blocking one eye. An artful dishevelment.
"What are you doing here?" the officer said. He had a dew-lapped face, eyes gone weary from seeing too much shit for too many nights.
"My pops works here," Joey said.
The second cop,
A tough-looking redhead with sun-beaten skin stood over Joey. We had an anonymous report of shots fired on this block.
Oh, yeah?
You hear anything?
All the time.
An annoyance passed between the cops. Care to elaborate?
Joey sighed, pocketed the phone. Come here.
She brushed past the redhead, took the driver by the arm, walked him to the curb, and pointed across the street.
See that alley there? There's an auto salvage yard at the end of it. That's where to go if you need a piece on the down low. A shitty little 22, something like that. That's what everyone says around here. People test the goods before they pay up.
She stood back, crossed her arms.
So, yeah, I heard shots fired. Tonight and every night.
The redhead let out a sigh that smelled of coffee and cigarettes. Let's go. She and her partner headed across the street and disappeared up the alley. Evan emerged from the darkness at the side of the store. Joey flipped him the keys she'd lifted from the driver's pocket. Evan thumbed the fob, popped the trunk to reveal a mounted gun locker safe. Also remote controlled. He thumbed another button on the keychain, and the gun locker opened with a brief metallic hum. Inside, cartons of shells and a Benelli M3 combat shotgun. His favorite. He grabbed two cartons, took the shotgun, then closed the gun locker and the trunk. He pointed at a spot on the sidewalk. Drop the keys there. Joey did. They walked over to the Subaru and drove off. 22. Dead Man's Pocket. The headquarters were on Northeast 13th at the very tip of Portland proper in a long-abandoned pest control shop sandwiched between a trailer lot and a precast concrete manufacturing plant. The drive over had been a descent into rough streets and heavy industry. Truck parts, machining, welding. Gentlemen's clubs were in evidence every few blocks, despite the absence of any actual gentleman. The small pest control shop, no bigger than a shack, had been retrofitted as a command center. Evan recognized the make of steel door securing the front entrance, the kind filled with water, designed to spread out the heat from a battering ram's impact. A ram would buckle before it would blow through a door like that. That was incredibly effective. When there wasn't a back door. Which Evan watched now. At the edge of the neighboring lot, he'd parked the Subaru between two used trailers adorned with cheery yellow and red sales flags. He had the driver's window rolled down, letting through a chilly stream of air that smelled of tar and skunked beer. Joey sat in the passenger seat, perfectly silent, perfectly still. Two cartons of different shotgun shells were nestled in his crotch, the shotgun across his lap. He had not loaded it yet. A few blocks over, a bad cover band wailed an Eagles tune through partially blown speakers. Somebody's gonna hurt someone before the night is through. Evan thought, you got that right. A Lincoln pulled up to the rear curb of the building. Evan sensed Joey tense beside him. A broad-shouldered man climbed out of the sedan. He knocked on the back door. Shave and a haircut, two bits. Even at this distance, the seven-note riff reached the Subaru through the crisp air. A speakeasy hatch squeaked open, a face filling the tiny metal square. A murmured greeting followed, and then various deadbolts retracted, the door swung inward, and the broad-shouldered man disappeared inside. Now Evan knew how he wanted to load the shotgun. 1 9-pellet buckshot load for the chamber, two more on its heels in the mag tube. He followed those with three shock-lock cartridges and had a pair of buckshot shells run anchor. He popped in the triangular safety so it was smooth to the metal, the red band appearing on the other side. When he pumped the shotgun, he felt the shock-shock in the base of his spine. "Stay here," he said. He reached for the door handle, then paused. "You may not like what you're about to see." He got out, swung the door closed behind him. He walked across the desolate street, bits of glass grinding beneath his tread. The midnight black Benelli hung at his side. He could feel Jack fall into step beside him, hear Jack's voice, a whisper in his ear.
It's too late for me.
I'm sorry I wasn't there,
Evan said quietly.
I want to know that I'm forgiven.
You are.
Evan quickened his stride, bearing down on the door. He knocked out the brief melody and raised the shotgun, seating the butt on his good shoulder.
I love you, son.
The speakeasy hatch squeaked open, and Evan pushed the muzzle into the surprised square of face, and fired. There was no longer a face. He shoved the shotgun farther inside, the muzzle clearing the door, and unleashed two buckshot rounds, one to the left, one to the right. The three shock locks were up next, copper-powdered, heavy-compressed centered shots that provided a total energy dump on one spot, with no scatterback or frag. Hinge removers. He shifted the action to manual so he could cycle the low-powered breaching rounds and give them more steam. Then he stepped back and fired top to bottom. Boom, boom, boom. The last slug knocked the door clear off the frame, sending it skidding across the floor. Cycling buckshot into the chamber and toggling the switch back to auto-load, he stepped through the dust into the metallic tang of cordite, shotgun raised. The blow radius effect of the initial blasts in the contained shop was biblical. With no air movement, the powdered smoke had stratified, hovering like gray mist. Five men, either dead or in various stages of critical injury, shuddered on knocked-over folding chairs, tilted against blood-stained walls, sprawled over a central table. No sign of the orphan. The broad-shouldered man was the only one able to do more than bleed out. He bellied across the floor, dragging himself away with his forearms. A combat crawl. His right leg was a mottled fusion of denim and flesh. He kept on, making for a rack of rifles and shotguns beside the steel front door. Evan walked toward him, stuck a toe in his ribs, flipped him over. The man tried to look away.
Oh, God, he said. You're... Are you... Orphan X? Oh, God.
Evan seated a boot square on his barrel chest, hovered the hot muzzle over his throat.
You killed Jack Johns.
The man's fine hair, so blonde it was almost gray, was shaved in a buzz cut. His scalp showed through, glistening with sweat.
No, not me. I didn't go up in the chopper, man. There was a special crew.
But you were there. On the ground in Alabama. You were all there.
Yes.
Evan swung the shotgun to the side and blew off his hand. The howl was inhuman. But so was making a man in his 70s jump out of a Black Hawk with his wrists cuffed together. Evan rotated the Benelli back to the man's head. Van Sciver, he said. Where?
Somewhere behind them, a final sputtering wheeze extinguished. I don't know. I swear... Never even met him.
Evan moved the Benelli over the guy's other hand.
Wait! Wait! I'll tell you. Tell you everything. Just don't... Don't take me apart like this.
How many freelancers did he bring in? Not including the Hilo crew.
25. He hired 25 of us.
Evan surveyed the wreckage, added it to the train station tally. 15 now, he said.
16.
The man risked a look at his hand, failed to fight off a full-body shudder.
I make 16.
And then, more desperately,
I still make 16.
Who's running point here? The man looked over at the red-smeared linoleum where his hand once was and dry-heaved. His face was pale, awash in sweat. Evan put more pressure on his chest, cracking a rib, snapping him back to attention.
Jordan Thornhill, the man said. Orphan R. Nicest guy in the world. Until he kills you.
What's he look like?
Black dude. All muscle. Could scale a cliff with his bare hands he wanted to.
The man started hyperventilating.
God. Oh, God. I think I'm bleeding out.
You've got enough for the next 5 minutes. Where is he?
Van Sciver called him home. I don't know where.
Evan twitched the barrel slightly.
I don't know where.
I don't know anything, I swear. They keep us in the dark about everything.
Evan let the weight of the hot barrel press into the hollow of the man's throat. The flesh sizzled. Not improving your situation, hired man.
Hang on. I overheard Thornhill saying something about a female orphan. Candy something. Orphan V.
At this, Evan's face tightened.
Please.
Saliva sheeted between the man's lips.
That's all I know. I told you everything. Can I? Will you let me live?
You were dead the minute Van Sciver told you my name. Evan pulled the trigger. He heard a creak behind him and pivoted, dropping the empty shotgun and drawing his Ares. He found himself aiming at Joey. She stood in the doorway, surveying the wreckage. A flush had come up beneath her smooth brown cheeks. The shack smelled of blood iron and the insides of men. Through the lingering smoke, her emerald eyes glowed, unguarded, overwhelmed. I told you to stay in the car.
I'm fine.
Pull the car around. Hurry. She stepped back and was gone. He flung a corpse off the central table and rifled through the items beneath. Coffee cups, battery packs, a half-eaten sub. Useless. Beneath a pack of black gel pens, he found a red-covered notebook. Seizing it, he thumbed through the stiff pages. Nothing inside. He tossed it, moved to the chipped counter M-dashing half of the east wall. Coffee pot, microwave, utility sink. The cabinet beneath held rusted pipes, water spots, a crusted bottle of Drano. He turned in his crouch, giving the room a last hurried scan. Blood dripped from the edge of the table. A strip of duct tape shimmered beneath the lip. A laptop adhered to the table's underside. He tore it free and turned for the door. As he stepped over what was left of the broad-shouldered man, something chimed. Evan paused to fish a familiar-looking Samsung Galaxy from the dead man's pocket. He used the man's shirt to wipe a crimson smear off the screen. Location services were toggled off, GPS disabled. Out front, he heard the Subaru squeal to the curb. Keeping the phone, he exited through the fortified steel door. As it swung open, he heard the faint slosh of water within. It was a nice security measure, if you thought about it. 23. Damaged goods. As Joey sped away, Evan checked out the Samsung. It appeared to be wiped of data, holding only the operating system and a single app. Signal. The encrypted comms software showed several incoming contact attempts. Sirens wailed, a squadron of cop cars rocketing past one block over on Lombard Street, blues and reds lasering through the night air. Joey had gotten them quickly away from the pest control shop. She darted nervous glances at the seemingly endless procession. The cruisers were visible only at intersections and alleys, strobing into view behind warehouses and buildings. We're fine, Evan said. Get on the 5. And then? Head north. Signal only worked over Wi-Fi, but God bless Portland's waxed mustaches, artisanal beers, and municipal benefits. They remained under the umbrella of free citywide service. The sirens reached an ear-splitting pitch and then faded quickly. Joey blew out a breath, letting it puff her cheeks. Evan kept his eyes on the Samsung, waiting for it to chime. Joey said, "What are you?" It chimed. Two words appeared, eventful azure. Joey glanced over at him. Her eyes held the frantic alertness of cornered prey.
That's him, isn't it?
Evan tapped the screen. Van Sciver's voice came through. Code. You don't need to bother with that anymore, Evan said. A long, static-free pause ensued. Van Sciver finally spoke again. How did you hack this connection? I didn't, Evan said. I hacked your men instead. He let Van Sciver digest that fact. 40% of his manpower. Gone. Freelancers were replaceable, sure, but getting them vetted, up to operational standards, and read in on an orphan mission, took time. And time was a luxury Evan wasn't going to allow him. Van Sciver had lit the fuse the instant he'd put Jack in that Black Hawk. Evan checked to see if the Wi-Fi connection had dropped, but they were still in range. Van Sciver finally replied, X. Y. I didn't figure you'd hang around the area. After you surface, you always go to ground. Things are different now. Ah, right. The old saw. This time it's personal. I thought you were better than that. Evan let the line hum. Jack jumped out of that helo himself, Van Sciver said. You watched it with me. We didn't push him. But you were going to. Yes, Van Sciver said. We were. Evan pointed through the windshield, then Joey veered up the on-ramp, accelerating onto the five. Can't blame me, can you? Van Sciver said. Hell, I learned it from you. To be ruthless. From me. You had to be. You were never the best. Everyone loves a thoroughbred, sure. But they root for the underdog. Who's rooting, Charles? Van Sciver kept on. Hell of a move you pulled all those years ago back at the home. Beat me to the starting gate. That was long ago. It was the past, yes. And it's the present, too. You define me, Evan. Just like I define you. Evan watched the headlights blur past on the freeway. He could sense Joey's gaze heavy on his face. The mystery man wanted me, Van Sciver said. Not you. Yes, Evan said. He did. We were so young. Remember when we thought he was important? Remember when he held all the power in the world? I remember. Now he works for me. The program's pared down, way down. But when I decided to recruit a little fresh blood, well, he's still the best. Though even he makes a mistake now and again. Like the girl. I'm sure she's told you all about it. Joey's hands tightened on the wheel. Van Sciver's voice, deep and confident, was carrying from the receiver. A mistake, Evan echoed. I asked her how to find you. She couldn't tell me anything. She's not even bait. She's useless. Joey looked straight ahead, drove steady, but Evan could hear her breathing quicken. She's another stray mark we have to erase, Van Sciver said. She knows my face. What's she gonna do? Hire a sketch artist? She doesn't have the skills. She's damaged goods. She's not even worth killing. Yeah, but Johns took her in, so I'm gonna kill her anyway. Because he took her in. Because that makes her important to you. Your call to make, Evan said, if you think you can afford not to concentrate on me. Van Sciver sounded amused. You have no idea, do you, how high it goes? What does that mean? He laughed. You still think it's about me and you? That is all it's about, Evan said, from the minute you took Jack. The reception weakened and then came back, the Subaru skirting the edge of the Wi-Fi hot zone. For years, I'd reconciled myself to living off the radar. Evan said, I was content to hide in the shadows, to leave you alone. Not anymore. Joey had inched above the speed limit, and Evan gestured for her to slow down. Evan, Van Sciver said, that's what we're counting on. The connection fizzled into static, then dropped. Evan turned off the Samsung and pocketed it. He leaned to check the speedometer. Keep it at 65. Joey's chest rose with each breath, her nostrils flaring. Not worth killing? She shot his words back at him. Everything's strategic, Joey. Didn't seem that way to me. We don't have time for this, he said. What? He tore the dangling duct tape off the laptop and popped it open. Your feelings. They drove in silence.
24. A Teaching Moment. Given the events at Portland Union Station, Evan decided to get Joey safely out of the state before parting ways. In the past, he'd had a few near misses with Van Sciver around Los Angeles, so Van Sciver likely knew that Evan had a base there. Putting himself in Van Sciver's shoes, Evan figured he'd bulk up surveillance on routes leading south from Oregon. So rather than head for California, Evan and Joey rode the bell curve of the I-90, routing up through Washington and cutting across the chimney stack of Idaho. They swapped seats at intervals, Evan driving the current leg. His attempts to access the laptop had been unsuccessful. The Dell Inspiron had proved to be heavily encrypted. Breaking in would require time, focus, and gear, none of which he could get until he had Joey off his hands. Van Sciver's words returned, a whisper in his ear. "You have no idea, do you, how high it goes? You still think it's about me and you." No matter how many ways Evan turned the conversation over in his head, he couldn't make sense of it. Van Sciver was working off an agenda unknown to Evan. That scared him. It felt as though Van Sciver were sitting at the chessboard, and Evan was a pawn. It was 10 hours and change to Helena, Montana, a destination chosen for its unlikeliness and because they had to cross 3 state lines to get there. His stomach started complaining in hour 6. It had been nearly 18 hours since he'd eaten. Joey had finally dozed off, slumped against the passenger window, a spill of hair curled in the hollow of her neck. It was good to see her sleeping peacefully. Evan pulled off at a diner, braking gently so as not to wake her. He parked behind the restaurant, out of sight from the road, and reached to shake her awake. She jolted upright, shouting and swinging, "Get off me! Get off!" Awareness came back into her eyes, and she froze, backed against the door, fists raised, legs pulled in, ready to kick. Evan had leaned away, giving her as much space as possible. He'd taken the brunt of her fist off the top of his forehead. If he'd been a second slower, she would have rebroken his nose. Her chest was still heaving. He waited for her to lower her shoulders, and then he relaxed his. She unpacked from her protective curl, looked around. "Where are we?" "I thought we'd get some food." She straightened her clothes. "This isn't a thing, okay? Like some big window into me." "Okay. You don't know anything about me. You don't know what happened to me. Or didn't happen to me. Okay. I just have a temper is all." Evan said, "I'd noticed." They sat in a booth in the far back of the empty diner, Evan facing out. Despite the stuffing peeking through the cracked vinyl benches, the restaurant was clean and tidy and appealed to his sense of order. The aroma of strong coffee and fresh-baked pies thickened the air. A wall-o-matic jukebox perched at the end of their table, the 5 satins shoo-do and shooby-dooing in between hoping and praying. Salt-and-pepper shakers, syrup bottles, and sugar jars gathered around the shiny crumb speaker, like children at story time. From the old-school baseball pennants to the inevitable Maryland poster, the manufactured nostalgia made the place seem like a location from a TV show, a faux diner set decorated to look like a real diner. Evan ate egg whites scrambled with spinach and dosed heavily with Tabasco. Joey picked at a stack of pancakes, furrowing the pooled butter with the lines of her fork. Conversation had been in short supply since the incident in the car. Evan set down his fork, squaring it to the table's edges. A few drops of coffee formed a braille pattern next to his plate, remnants from the waitress's lazy pour. He resisted for a few seconds, and then caved, wiping them clean with his napkin. Joey remained fascinated with her pancakes. Her rucksack rested next to her, touching her thigh, the closely guarded life possessions of a street dweller. Evan searched for something to say. He had no experience when it came to matters like this. His unconventional upbringing had turned him into something sleek and streamlined, But when he collided with the everyday, he felt blunt, unwieldy. Then again, he supposed she wasn't very good at this either. He watched her eviscerate her short stack. If you're fighting off an attacker, a real attacker, go for the throat or eyes, he finally said, up and under. If you swing for the head, he can just duck, protect his face, take the blow off the top of the forehead where the skull is thickest. Her mouth gaped, but for once, no words were forthcoming. He sensed he had said something wrong. "Are you seriously turning this into a teaching moment?" she said. The best course of action, he decided, was to consider the question rhetorical. But she pressed on. "Everything doesn't have to be some learning experience." He thought of his upbringing in Jack's farmhouse, where every task and chore held the weight of one's character. Making the bed, drying the dishes, lacing your boots. How you do anything is how you do everything. "Yes," Evan said. "It does." "You've seen me fight," she said. "I know how to fight. That wasn't about fighting. It was just a startle response." "A startle response?" "Yes." "You need a better startle response." She shoved her plate away. "Look, I just got caught off guard." "There is no off guard, Joey. Not once you get on that bus in Helena. Not for a second. That's how it is. You know this." She collected herself, then nodded. "I do." She met his stare evenly, throat and eyes. Though the sky still showed a uniform black, a few early hours patrons filtered in. Truckers with stiff hats, farmers with worn jeans, and hands that rasped against their menus. "You'll be okay," Evan said. "The farther you are from me, the safer you'll be." "You heard him. He's not going to let me go. He's going to have his hands full. I think we're safer together." "Like at your apartment? The train station? That pest control shop in Central East Side?" She held up her hands. "We're here, aren't we? And they're not." The sugary scent of the syrup roiled his stomach. "This isn't. Can't be good for you. I can handle it. You're 16. What were you doing at 16? She glared at him. "Well, was it good for you? Or is that different? Because, you know, I'm a girl." "I don't care that you're a girl. I care that you're safe. And where I'm going, it's not going to be safe." A patter of footsteps announced the waitress's approach. "I just started my shift and already I'm winded trudging all the way to you two back here." She grabbed her ample chest, made a show of catching her breath. Evan managed to smile. "Anything else I can get you or your daughter, sweetie?" Evan touched her gently on the side, not low enough to be disrespectful. "Just the check, thanks. It's really nice, you know, to see a road trip. I wish my daddy spent time with me like that." As she dug in her apron pocket, Joey gave her a look that bordered on toxic. The waitress pointed at her with a corner of the check. "Mark my words, you'll appreciate this one day." She spun on her heel, a practiced flourish, and left them. The bill had been deposited demurely face down. Evan laid 2 20s across it, started to slide out. Joey said, "I didn't do it." He paused. "What?"
"The duffel bag. The guy. I didn't do it. I couldn't pull the trigger."
Evan let his weight tug him back into the seat. He folded his hands, gave her room to talk. Or to not talk. She took her time. Then she said, "I stood there with the gun aimed, Van Sciver at my back. And I couldn't." "What did he do?"
"He took the gun out of my hand and showed me."
Her lips trembled, and she pressed her knuckles against them hard.
"The mag was empty. It was just a test. And I failed. If I'd done it. If I'd passed the test. I could have been like...
She caught herself. Broke off the thought. Could have been like what?
Like you.
Silence asserted itself around them. Kitchen sounds carried to their booth. Pots clanking. Grills sizzling. In a booming voice, the short-order cook was telling the staff that he hadn't had much luck with the rainbow trout, but he had a new spinning lure that just might do the trick.
Van Sciver unzipped the duffel. Let the guy out. He was acting all along. Probably some psyops instructor. Van Sciver said he was going to walk him out, that I should wait there for him. But the thing is...
Her voice hushed.
I noticed something standing there, looking down at the duffel bag. It had a smudge of blood on the lining. And I knew that I hadn't just failed the test. I'd failed Van Sciver. And at some point it would be me in that duffel bag, and another kid outside it. And when that happened, the gun wouldn't be empty.
She sat back, breaking the spell of the memory.
That raised office in the hangar. It had a window with a shitty lock. I kept a hairpin hidden in my hair. I thought it'd be wise to GTFO before he got back. So I did. I was on the run 11 months. Until Jack.
How'd Jack find you? The distinctive ring sounded so out of place, here among the retro candy apple red vinyl and Elvis clocks and display counter up front stocked with dentine. It was a ring from another place. Another life. Another dimension.
It was the Rome Zone.
Someone needed the Nowhere Man.
25. Honor Bound. The Rome Zone's caller ID generated a reverse directory, auto-linking to a Google Earth map of central L.A. Evan zoomed in on a single-story residence in the Pico Union neighborhood. The phone rang again. And again. Evan's thumb hovered over the talk button. He could not answer this call. It was out of the question. He had a girl to unload, a laptop to hack into, a death to avenge. Jack's murder had sent Evan's life careening sharply off course. His dying message had shattered any semblance Evan retained of order, routine, procedure. He should be home right now, concerned only with his vodka supply and his next workout. Instead, he was in a diner outside Missoula, stacking his proverbial plate higher and higher until everything on it threatened to topple. Why hadn't Jack made arrangements for Joey? Why had he saddled Evan with her? Jack had known that Evan had his own honor-bound obligations as the Nowhere Man. Jack had known that being a lone wolf had been drummed into Evan's cells. Hell, Jack had done the drumming himself. Jack had to have known that Joey would be an inconvenient aggravation at the very moment that Evan's universe would compress down in the service of a single goal. The annihilation of Charles Van Sciver. An unsettling thought occurred. What if there was some design behind the plan? Jack's teachings always carried a hint of back alley's end to them. If you don't know what you don't know, how can you know what to learn? But why this? What could Evan possibly have to gain from this disruption? Everything doesn't have to be a learning experience. And Jack answered him, as clearly as if he'd been facing him across the breakfast table, in that quiet farmhouse in the Virginia woods. Yes, it does. Evan banished the thought. There was no design, no artful master plan. Jack had found himself at the end of the road, and had sent up a flare because he'd been desperate and needed Evan to clean up his mess. It was nothing more. Joey was staring at him. You gonna answer that? Another ring. He clenched his teeth. Gave Joey a firm look. Do not speak. Her nod was rushed, almost eager. He answered as he always did. Do you need my help?
Yes. Please, yes.
The man's gravelly voice had a tightness to it not uncommon for people calling the number for the first time. like he was forcing the words up and out. A heavy accent. Hispanic, but not Mexican. It was just past 4 in the morning. Evan imagined the man pacing in his little house, clutched in the towel.